pop yourself a beer or a cold libation. Let me tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from Brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some movie clips of popcorn fighting, fantasy explorations and some groundless exploitation, kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxing, school month or a movie marathon. Sometimes I let the dogs come on, contests and of course you know it's all about games. That's a slogan, let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds RPG Variety Podcast. With the other Jason.
Welcome back to the Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I'm your host, Jason. Today is another episode in our ongoing retrospective of Walter Hill films. Today, we are going to cover 48 Hours and its sequel, Another 48 Hours. And I'm thrilled to have joining me to discuss these movies, Joe Salvador of Raven Guy Games. How are you doing today, Joe?
I am doing really well, Jason. How are you doing, man?
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you so much for coming on the show to talk with me about these movies.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Maybe real quick background before we get into the movies at all. But when was the first time you remember seeing these movies?
Well, that's a really interesting question because, you know, I had mentioned it offline. I do remember certain scenes. So as I rewatched 48 Hours, just a few scenes stuck out to me. Like, yeah, I've definitely seen this and I've seen this, but I don't know that I've ever actually seen the whole movie. It would have been in the 80s. It would have had to have been in the 80s. And Another 48 Hours, I don't think I've ever seen that. Those are
really
my first watch. Yeah, it was my first watch.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen these. So I didn't see either of these in the theater, but I know I've seen them both on, you know, in the 80s on HBO. 48 Hours was on fairly heavy rotation, even on regular TV, a heavily edited version, obviously. But
that's probably how I saw it. TV.
And they even had a TV version of 48 Hours that had a bunch of scenes that aren't in the theatrical cut because they had to take out so much. We'll get into it. But of course, this is full spoilers, folks. If you haven't watched these movies, go check them out. That you can find them, you can rent them. They're out there, and there's going to be explicit podcasts. We're not going to try to curse to offend you or anything. But if we slip and say something or need to say something, that's fine. But the F bomb is dropped 48 times in 48 hours in the movie, right? So the funny thing is there are other words in here, like in the N word that were shown on TV, you know, network TV, where the F bomb, of course, gets edited out, right? But yeah, so they had, but this was on 80s. TV. It was on HBO. I know I've seen Another 48 Hours more than I saw 48 Hours just because the heavy rotation. You know, while I was growing up, I don't know when did Another 48 Hours. I know I've seen them both.
That was 1990.
That was 90. So yeah, because it would have been on those, and we would have had it on like in the barracks and watching it and all that. So I don't know. I want to say I've seen Another 48 Hours more times, but I've seen both these a fair amount from back.
Okay.
Then.
Okay. That's kind of, like I said, I probably saw at least parts of 48 Hours back in the day, but it's almost like these are brand new to me. I forgot so much about it. Yeah.
So that there's going to be a good discussion because part of 48 Hours is it's so set in the 80s, right? And actually it's really late 70s movie in feel. You know, Walter Hill approached every movie he made as a Western, or he makes. You know, and you can kind of see that in here. You can especially see it in Another 48 Hours in certain ways. In this movie here, in 48 Hours, you know, the script goes back as far as 1971 in its original iteration. You know, it was a totally different movie back then. Lawrence Gordon, you probably saw his name at the beginning of the movie, credits and all. Lawrence Gordon came up with the original idea. The governor of Louisiana's daughter had been kidnapped by a criminal. They strapped dynamite to her head, threatened to blow her up in 48 hours if ransom's not paid. So they get the meanest cop they can find to go to the prison to get his former roommate, you know, his former cellmate. And then you have this adventure. And that was the original setup for this. And it went through all kinds of draft iterations. For a while there, they wanted Clint Eastwood to be the convict. And then he was in Escape from Alcatraz. So, you know, they didn't want, he didn't want to, they Eastwood didn't want to play the cop because he already had Dirty Harry going and he didn't want to have conflicts between the studios. They had wanted Richard Pryor for this. Richard Pryor was on the way up, but you know, by the time this all panned out, he was doing other things. In fact, The Toy came out the same time this came out in theaters.
And if I remember correctly, in that, the interview with director, Walter Hill, he said that, Pryor wouldn't have gotten top billing. So I think that might've been part of it as well. So
that may have been because Pryor had made a big jump up by the time he finally got around to making this. Now he would work with Pryor. He would eventually work with Pryor, Walter Hill would, for Brewster's Millions. But the next person they were looking at was Gregory Hines, who very well could do this. Gregory Hines is in a great buddy cop movie called Running Scared with Billy Crystal from 1986. But eventually their Gregory Hines schedule didn't work. And Walter Hill's girlfriend at the time was the agent for Eddie Murphy. And Eddie Murphy had just been on Saturday Night Live, you know, and Eddie Murphy was the only reason Saturday Night Live was still in the air at this point, really. I don't know if you're, I remember watching Saturday Night Live with my dad, or my dad watching Saturday Night Live, you know, when I was there with Eddie Murphy on there and watching like Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood.
It's classic stuff. Right?
So I, you know, I remember that time, but this is Eddie Murphy's first movie and he was 21 years old in this movie. And you think about it, he does for his very first movie at 21 years old. He's great in this. He really is.
He steals the show.
He really does. He's kind of rough in a lot of ways in here. And apparently he was really bad when he first showed up and they, you know, cause he wasn't a trained actor, you know, cause live and being a comedian is not the same as being a film actor, you know?
Absolutely.
Paramount wanted to get rid of him and Walter Hill had to fight to keep him. And he got an acting coach on there. Nick Nolte apparently worked with him and helped him out. And they even saved the torchy scene, the big scene in the bar for the last thing they shot. So he, you know, he'd be at his best. Yeah. And, but you know, what's cool here is Nick Nolte steps back and lets Eddie Murphy do his thing in this movie. There are a lot of actors that don't, they're not as generous. They wouldn't have shared the screen as well with this new brand new actor is Nick Nolte does here with Eddie Murphy, you know?
It's very, it seems like number of lines and number of scenes. I think it's very equal. Even, you know, maybe Eddie Murphy even has some more screen time. I'm not sure, but it seems like a lot.
So it's written as Nick Nolte's movie, the cops movie.
He's top billed, I think.
He is. And at the time, I mean, he was a much bigger than Eddie Murphy, you know? But Eddie Murphy doesn't come in till like half an hour into the movie.
That's true.
Yeah. Nick Nolte gets a more screen time. And if you look at the story beats and the dialogue and everything, you know, it's Nick Nolte's story, right? He's our hero. He's supposed to be the hero, you know,
it's supposed to be the hero.
Well, we're going to talk about it. Right. But, you know, his gun gets stolen. He has to get his gun back. So he has to get this convict out of prison to help him get his gun back. But in the end of the movie, he shoots the bad guy. You know, Nick Nolte has all the hero beats in here, really. Not all, you know, the majority of the hero beats. And he's supposed to be the hero, but you're right. Eddie Murphy steals the show. And even though he doesn't have as much screen time, Eddie Murphy
maybe
feels like he does.
Maybe it's just because that he does such a good job in it. Maybe that's why I feel like he does have equal time. I don't know. But you're right. There's quite a bit of in the front end of the movie where, you know, Nick Nolte's by himself and it's kind of leading up to that. So,
We're not going to go beat by beat with this. We might talk about some favorite scenes and we're going to talk more in general about this movie because we're going to assume that people have seen it. But the real basic thing. Well, I guess the other thing I want to mention before we get into it is this is often shown as the first buddy cop movie or the genesis of that genre. And that's not really true. There were buddy cops movies before this. I mean, like Kurosawa did Stray Dog. That's a buddy cop movie. You know, that's 1949. Mm-hmm. And then we have other movies where you have like The Odd Couple pairing up kind of like, yeah, The Defiant Ones, right? Mm-hmm. 1958 with Tony Curtis and Sidney Poitier. You have In the Heat of the Night. Yeah, but there are some other movies out there that also kind of fit this bill. I mean, Walter Hill had written Hickey and Boggs, actually, which, okay. You know, Robert Culp and Cosby. And so, you know, and that effectively is a buddy movie. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and Freebie and the Bean, which James Caan, Alan Arkin. So there are other movies out there.
Like a plethora of movies in your brain, man. Like, I'm like, I don't know any of these films.
Yeah. I'm reading off some notes here, but
oh, okay.
Overall, if you're interested in the genre, they're worth checking out. Definitely. And we even have had other, you know, pairings. We've had like the various Corman, like women in prison films, escape films,
where
like a black prisoner and a white prisoner that mm-hmm. yeah. together, shackled together.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I mentioned before that I felt like this movie almost has roots in sort of like the blaxploitation genre. Like there's a lot of stuff in here that is similar to me. Like it had almost a similar feel, but you're right. What's the film with Pam Grier's Black Mama, White Mama? Very similar.
Yeah, Black Mama, White Mama, and you had like the Big Birdcage, and mm-hmm. some other ones. You know, it's interesting. There's a podcast I listen to called The Michaud Mission, and it's a couple of African American filmmakers trying to cover mm-hmm. all the, you know, black films out there, they covered this. And to them, this is a quintessential black film because you can't replace Eddie Murphy with a white actor and have the same movie. And
absolutely,
sure, yeah. Like you can't take and put Bill Murray in that spot mm-hmm. and work the same.
Yeah.
Where there are a lot of movies that, you know, you probably could to some degree, right? But, you know, like Lethal Weapon, you mm-hmm. can replace Danny Glover with a white actor.
Yeah, I can see that.
The movie still works, right?
Sure.
So
interesting. Now, You could do it.
And it'd be a
interesting way to define that. Like, what is a black film? And if you're right, if you can replace one of the leads for an actor, either a white actor or somebody who's a different background, and it changes it. That's really interesting to me. I've never heard that before, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good podcast. I'd highly recommend it. And cool. They've been around for years. The back catalog's worth checking out.
Excellent.
I'll put a link in the show notes to that. But so anyway, this isn't the first, but this did kick off the buddy cop genre. There are a lot of, even though it's not the first, you can see these story beats in for other movies. And you can mm-hmm. see this early on because there are story beats in this movie that should be done better, but aren't. But that's because they're still kind of getting the feel for things, right? Like in the beginning, you know, Nick Nolte should have been partners with his buddy that ends up getting shot there in the beginning.
Mike Ermintrout.
Yeah.
Algren, I think was his name.
Yeah. Yeah. He should have been buddies with him, with Jonathan, mm-hmm. Jonathan Banks, right? Character.
Yeah.
And we're they should have been partners. They were buddies, but they should have been partners going into this, but they weren't. And there are some mm-hmm. other steps that feel like they're missteps, but it's mm-hmm. because this is the other movie's copied.
Yeah, right. And, you know, I was surprised that, you know, just the sheer number of, tropes that we see in it. And yeah, I mean, from what I read, it seems like the majority of it started right here, right?
Yeah, well, it did. Yeah. And so, you know, I listed all those other movies that this kind of draws from and ideas. But mm-hmm. I mean, this deserves a place in it. So it's done two things that deserves a place in history. One is this is Eddie Murphy's first movie, mm-hmm. and he comes out of the gate swinging. I mean, when you see him in Torchy's, when you see him in that redneck bar, that's Eddie Murphy, and that's the Eddie Murphy mm-hmm. that we get in Beverly Hills Cop and mm-hmm. on and on, that's the movie star. And out of the gate, he's doing great. So it's important for that reason. But it's also all these other buddy cop movies or buddy movies, because they're not even both cops in this movie, right? So this mm-hmm. is a movie. But they definitely copy off this. When you look at these later ones, like we talk about Lethal Weapon, or even if you're talking like The Last Boy Scout, or you're talking,
mm-hmm.
whatever, they're pulling from this movie. There's no question about it. I guess the real quick background, it doesn't really matter. Like I say, go watch the movie. You've got Escape in the Beginning, which we should talk about this. So the very first lines you get in the movie are racist lines. So you can't mm-hmm. talk about this movie and not talk about the racism or the misogyny in the movie, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think the racism in the movie overshadows the misogyny conversation, which is kind of a shame, because that's really, in the end, I think worse. Because yeah. the racism part, I mean, yeah, I'm not defending racism at all. I'm not saying any of it's mm-hmm. any good. But when you look at other movies of the time, and I'm not using that as an excuse, but some of this isn't atypical for what we saw at the time. And for people that were around back then, like it or not, you know, the world was different, right? So it's
and,
not.
Yeah, we'll get more into the racism thing. And like, you know, there are some lines towards the end that are like sort of like apologetic about mm-hmm. that, but you don't get that for the misogyny. I mean,
right.
Yeah. Spoiler, Nick Nolte takes a woman hostage in this movie and he's a cop.
well, and Eddie Murphy's, like I say, we're going to say some, you know, this isn't necessarily the show to have your kids watching or listen to, yeah. with, right? But, you know, Eddie Murphy is referring to women as trim, and he does mm-hmm. that to their face.
Oh, yeah.
In the bar.
Yeah, it's just like the yeah. normal thing, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
It's the misogyny here is you know, and the it's bad. And
yeah, it's really bad. Yeah. I mean, from the start to the end, women are either goals or they're objects to be pushed aside or used to get what you need, not only like physically, but like information or whatever. And they're just treated horribly. They're talked to horribly. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it's actually probably worse than the racism, simply because there are beats in this film, like you mentioned, the redneck bar scene, where Murphy is able to push back against that.
Right.
And one, and two, Nick Nolte's character, like, kind of apologizes for the things he says and whatnot, which doesn't make it right, but it does kind of, you know, alleviate some of it to a point. Right.
Well, and they even address that. Right. So,
mm-hmm.
so we'll, like I say, we're going to assume people have seen the movie. So when you look at that at the end, you know, so we're near the end of the movie and Nick Nolte has called Eddie Murphy tons of different things that I don't think either of us want to repeat.
That's terrible.
It's horrible. And not just racist things, but he treats him mm-hmm. bad, he, you know, but you know, they're here at the end, they've kind of gotten along. They've get to understand each other better. They've got each other's backs to some degree now. And Nick Nolte now is, respect for Eddie Murphy because he's seen him and you know Eddie Murphy's proven himself, and Nick Nolte says, you know, I'm sorry for these things that I'm paraphrasing, I'm sorry for these things that I called you, you know, it was just I was doing my job as a cop to keep you down. Mm-hmm. And you know, Eddie Murphy says, yeah, but that's not all it was, you know, it wasn't all that. And
yeah,
and Nick
Nolte agrees, he's like,
no,
yeah,
it wasn't
something.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right. But when you think about it, and people can call in, maybe they've had different experiences. I've been around a lot of police officers. I have a ton of respect for police officers, but very much, and especially back then, yeah, mm-hmm. I'm not saying it doesn't happen today, but especially mm-hmm. back then, you had that hard outer shell, that armor they would put on, and that gruffness. Mm-hmm. And the idea of, I mean, we see the, you know, his boss, the captain in here calls,
yeah, he's using slurs, right? As well. Yeah.
Yeah, he's just as bad. And
yeah,
and he's black, right? Which is an argument against the racism of the movie too, because you're putting him in a position of power. You know,
right.
He's actually Nick Nolte's boss, right? But but that, with that hard shell, you know, the idea here is Nick Nolte himself isn't a horrible, you know, Klan member, racist, all this stuff, but he has to put hard armor on out in the world because he's got to go out and deal with people every day. And that's how he's been taught to interact and what he's been taught to do
yeah.
his job. And there's
absolutely. I agree. I think, you know, as many problems that this country has, with this country being the States, has with like policing today, it was far worse then. You know what I mean? And especially when you get, you know, kind of like, you know, not necessarily maybe in the big cities, probably in the big cities, I didn't live there, but in the country where you have like one sheriff who kind of like controls everything or whatever, that kind of power is easily corrupted. And it was, mm-hmm. You know, and I'm not a police historian or anything, but I don't think, I didn't feel like this movie was particularly unrealistic like that. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. And again, we're not saying you should use these terms, refer to other people by these terms or anything else.
Oh, God. No.
What Nick Nolte does is right in here. But like you say, it's not an unrealistic portrayal, honestly. Mm. Now there are a bunch of unrealistic things in the movie. It's an action movie. Sure. And so, you know, like the fact that paperwork hardly ever gets done. Oh, I'll write the report tomorrow. And, you know, we've got all these car crashes and shootouts and he just walks mm-hmm. away and does this, you know.
Yeah,
that's totally unrealistic, right?
Sure.
But some of this other stuff, there's a ring of truth to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And it's a horrible truth. This is a simple fact of it, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, I mean, this that was the country then.
And, right. But by the end of the movie, we have Nick Nolte defending Eddie Murphy against his captain. You know, he tells him,
mm-hmm. Yeah, he does.
More guts than any partner I ever had. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he's willing to go out on a limb for him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we also, the other reason we know Nick Nolte's the good guy in here and the script tells us, and we see through actions too. It's not just the script tells us, mm-hmm. but, you know, where Nick Nolte's, he's not corrupt. You know, this movie accepts that at the time, big city police, you know, there's corruption going on. You know, when they, in the very, that, like the second scene when they're going to the hotel before mm-hmm. his two buddies get shot, you know, and they're looking, that, you know, as soon as they go up to the lady at the desk, she's like, hey, you can't rouse me. I pay my protection, you know?
Yeah, like, oh, no, that's true.
Don't
worry.
Yeah, and the misogyny, don't worry, sweet pants. We're not here to do that, right?
Yeah, right. It's like nonstop, man. It's nonstop. Right. This movie.
But,
no, but you're right. Nick Nolte, you're right. He's like incorruptible. He doesn't even, when he has the option to take Eddie Murphy's money, his millions or whatever, he doesn't take it. He doesn't want, he says, it's not my style. You know, that's an interesting point. Yep.
Yeah. So, and you know, it's interesting because he definitely could have seized that money. And if he didn't mm-hmm. keep it, he could have turned it in,
but oh, yeah.
he didn't. And, mm-hmm. and that says something about his character.
And yeah, I think that's part of his, like you said, he had respect by that point for Eddie Murphy's character. And he was willing to help him out, work with him. And, not, you know, not treat him like the convict, basically. Like throughout most of the movie, he's convict, you know.
Right.
He's a lesser person, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah,
definitely. So, you know, and it's not just, you know, white, black, the racism against the Indian in here is horrible. Our mm-hmm. Native American character, who mm-hmm. actually everybody should recognize, Sonny Landon, who plays Billy.
Yeah, I was so happy to see him. Yeah.
Yeah. So now Sonny had worked with Water Hill before and would again. You know, Sonny was in, he was in
Southern Comfort. That's right.
Yep. And he's in the Warriors. He has a,
oh, I didn't know that.
He has a speaking role, but he's one of the policemen in the Warriors.
Oh,
and
cool.
In Southern Comfort, he's one of the hunters. Most people know him from, I almost want to say Firewalker, but nobody knows what Firewalker is.
it's Predator, man.
Predator, right. Yeah, most people know him as Billy Soul, the track mm-hmm. in Predator, right? And he kind of does the same thing in this, right? We see him at the end where he has the knife.
I was like, this is the same scene. Yeah.
this is pre-Predator though, but
mm-hmm, yep.
Yeah, so Sonny Landon's good in this, but the opening of the movie is him getting called a racial slur mm-hmm. right?
And, yeah, absolutely.
And even the officer on the chain gang there, you know, obviously James Remar's character Gantz, James Remar's Sonny's buddy, you know, they're buddies, mm-hmm. he's obviously playing it up, but even that corrections officer who wasn't in on it, you know, he's like, hey, calm down, chief, he didn't mean anything by it.
Yeah, you know. Fire water. He says all kinds of things,
right.
That
yeah.
you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Really good character. Honestly, I guess I not to switch gears or anything,
but
acting was pretty good overall. And like you said, some of these actors are relatively new actors. I thought James Remar was awesome. He was completely, you know, he was total madman, right? I mean, I had no problems with the acting. There were a few bits here and there where it was maybe unbelievable, but good action. I thought it flows really well, scene to scene. The movie moves quickly. Mm-hmm. Even towards the end, like particularly like the last sort of chase scene, there's some really cool cinematography, I thought, with like the mist and all that. I like that. That was a good scene.
Yeah. I think the cinematography is good. The music is good. So the music in here, you know, you've heard these beats before. This is James Horner, doesn't mm-hmm. And he did a bunch of stuff. He did Commando. There's a lot of the same beat. You know, we have like the steel drum and we have the saxophone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's really similar to what he did in Commando, and he's done other movies as well. So the, you know, the music's good, I think. I don't know if it's the music really fits San Francisco where this is set, but
yeah,
you know, it's fine.
Yeah, it's still good. And you know, there were bits that harkened back to like some of the 70s kind of funk stuff. And also to like some of like the film noirs, or like you said, saxophones, the jazz stuff. Yeah, I thought it was a good mix. Yeah.
No, and you mentioned film noir. Some of the way this film is shot is film noir. You know, when mm-hmm. when we have the two of them leaving the police station and the camera's over top of them, you know, that's a film noir shot. And there's some other shots in here that are really film right. noir kind of shots mm-hmm. that are really good. You mentioned the action really quickly. You know, this has a cast that you recognize mm-hmm. people, you know, folks.
If oh, yeah. You go lots of familiar faces.
Yeah. Poor Annette O'Toole. They don't give her anything to do, but yeah. Annette O'Toole's in here, you know, she's great. Frank McRae, who's the captain, we see him in numerous mm-hmm. things. James Remar, of course, was in The Warriors. He's in mm-hmm. The Long Riders, both with Walter Hill. He's great. David Patrick Kelly, of course, he's in mm-hmm. Commando. I mentioned Commando, Twin Peaks, and The Warriors. In fact, mm-hmm. you know, his name is Luther in The Warriors. That's Luther.
That's right. That's right.
Speaking of
reusing names.
Reusing well, names.
Billy is reused.
Yeah, Predator, Billy's reused, Billy. Right? Yep. But Billy Bear, and he's Billy in Predator. Mm-hmm. The bar, the redneck bar in here is Torchy's. Well, Torchy's is used in a ton of Walter Hill movies. You know, in Streets of Fire, the one bar was Torchy's. In this, the bar is Torchy's. And The Driver, which I don't think it's getting covered this year, there's a bar called Torchy's in The Driver. Brewster's Millions has a bar called mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Yeah, like that. Something that Walter Hill reuses a lot. But we have Byron James in here. You know, most people know him from, I guess, Blade Runner is where people know him from. Although he's in so many.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, but he's Leon in Blade Runner. He's the one replicant. But
yeah,
there's like we already mentioned Jonathan Banks. You know, he's people know him from like Breaking Bad or from mm-hmm. whatever. These days, just a ton of Denise Crosby, Tasha Yar. She's in here, you know, in an early performance, right? She doesn't get much to do, but she's in here.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, Olivia Brown's in here, you know, I mean, anybody that's watched Miami Vice knows Olivia Brown. She played Trudy on Miami Vice, right? So tons of recognizable faces throughout this. Peter Jackson is the bartender. He's in a bunch of stuff. You know, the other thing you get in here, which is kind of crazy, we talk about cool things in here, are we get basically a full music video by the Busboys in here at the end, right? Which is great. I mean, the Busboys are great. I love the music, but you know, Eddie Murphy's hanging out in the bar waiting, and Jack is speeding through the streets to meet him mm-hmm. and we get the whole song during that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you mentioned some of the chases. We get the bus chase, which you know was a little anticlimactic. Walter Hill would come back to this idea of bus chases later. He would do it again in Red Heat. He does it where they end up with two buses doing mm-hmm. the chase, right? And then there's a bus scene in another 48 Hours as well.
Mm-hmm. But
now overall I think the action in this movie is pretty good. I think you can follow the action. I don't think it's too hard to figure out where people are moving spatially mm-hmm. in these scenes, any of that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, like I said, the cinematography overall is pretty good. Like you said, you can see what's going on. Some cool shots, like of the city and of, you know, like landscaping, whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a San Francisco movie, and you can tell it's a San Francisco movie. You know, this, it looks right, and, mm-hmm. and they give you enough establishing shots and through the streets and things. I think is pretty good. Yeah, overall, you know, and the story for the most part's pretty good. Unlike we're mm-hmm. going to talk about another 48 hours here, but mm-hmm. unlike that movie that has plot holes you can drive buses through, you know, this is pretty tight. It's not perfect, but it's for an action movie, this is fine. And
yeah, I think it's pretty straightforward, easy to follow. Like I said, and like I said, it doesn't need to be super complicated or anything. Like
right,
They move from one scene to the next. Not necessarily linear, but there's some twists and turns. But overall, I think it's really well done. It's a good story.
Right. Yeah. I would agree with that. I think it makes sense. It works. And overall, I think it's a pretty good movie. It's got its problems. Like I say, especially the misogyny, I think is the big unanswered problem here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it because. And you know what makes that so horrible is this movie was rewritten and they worked on the script, and even they even had a scriptwriter on set helping rewrite, mm-hmm. you know, while they're going. Because like we had mentioned, Eddie Murphy is kind of new to this and he's learning mm-hmm. as he's going. And so Eddie Murphy ended up wanting to ad lib, but that doesn't really work on a movie as much.
Right.
And so
what
they did is they would go through the scenes and then they would write the ad-lib stuff in the script and then, you know, build it in the script.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So his contributions got in there, but it wasn't ad-lib like just, oh, cut that scene. That's a good one.
Cause sure.
You know, basically what, Walter Hill told Nick Nolte was, you know, Eddie Murphy, he's new, he's not a trained actor. So we're going to take 20 takes and only one of them is going to be good. We're going to use his good take. So all your mm-hmm. takes have to be good.
Yeah. Right?
which is kind of
no cool. pressure, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, and when they rewrote this though, I'm trying to look for the quote, but there's a quote in here about here it is. So this is from the guy they brought to help rewrite it near the end, and I just scrolled past it, so I'm gonna have to find his name, Larry Gross, and he's talking about the script and his answer when the misogyny is brought up is, and this is from one of the writers, one of the things I think that makes 48 Hours more interesting than the average kind of movie like this is that although women play relatively small roles in the narrative, they haunt everyone's imagination. The film really is this screwball comedy about men and women trying to get together and not get together, even though it is a very conventional gangster piece.
Yeah.
You know, that's not what I got out of the movie.
No, that is not the, I can see what he's saying. I don't think that's what the movie's about. But I definitely, you know, Reggie, he just got out of prison. So, you know, he's interested in finding some ladies. And Nick Nolte has a love interest who he's always like, just kind of out of reach with, right? Like,
right.
He's always on the job. He's never doesn't ever have time for his love interest and all that. So I get that point. Yeah, I agree. That's not what the movie's about.
No, and they didn't do a good job establishing it. It doesn't answer mm-hmm. that. Like mm-hmm. I say, really that misogyny piece. I mean, and we're not. I'm definitely not trying to wipe aside the idea that the racism stuff. I don't think this movie. I guess ultimately, if you watch this in the 80s, the language wasn't as shocking as it is today.
I can see that. Yeah, absolutely. When I watched this the other day, I felt like, holy smoke, what am I watching? Like, it was shocking. It was really shocking. And honestly, it was kind of a slog to get through it. And it, regardless of how, you know, how enjoyable the film is, because it is a good film. There was just uncomfortable. Some of it was uncomfortable for the modern viewer, I think.
Right.
I mean, it's, you know, we've mentioned the misogyny and the racism. There's homophobia in here as well. Like,
oh,
I
true.
Mean,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just one thing after another. But like you said, I mean, it's definitely a product of its time. And I we hear that all the time, and it's not, it doesn't make it right, certainly. Right. It's something you have to, you know, every viewer is going to have to, you know, make their peace with. They're either going to watch it or they're not. And that's, you know, if you don't, I would say I'll probably never watch this movie again. I mean, I've seen it. I've actually, like, it's kind of the same movie that we see in like kind of like the derivatives, right?
Right.
So yeah, I mean, it like I said, it was just parts of it are hard to get through. Eddie Murphy had me in the cowboy bar scene. I mean, I think that's a pretty important scene, you know?
Yeah, it is. And the fact they put that scene in there, you can tell he's going to be a movie star at that point because he owns that scene. He does great. scene.
Mm-hmm.
He really does. And yeah, so, you know, what, like you say, if you watch this or not, you understand it's not written for modern audiences. And I don't mean that in the way it sounds. I'm not making an excuse for it, but from our modern sensibilities, this is a lot rougher than it was when it came out. And, you know, this is a Christmas movie, you know, when it came out in December of 1982.
Wow.
Yeah. So let's talk.
The holidays were different back then.
That's right. Yeah. Anything else you want to mention on 48 Hours before we move on to the sequel?
Let's see. So we had talked about, let me see, random stuff. Questionable elements. I had a question for you offline that we had talked about, so it's not a surprise for you. Is this movie criticizing policing in America at the time that it was made?
I don't think it shies away from it at all, because we see in there about the idea of the police force on the take. We see the idea that, you know, that one hotel's paying protection to the police, you know, don't hassle me, I already paid this week. And sure. And nobody denies any of that stuff, you know, and Nick Nolte's like, I'm not that kind of cop, you know, so I don't think it I don't think it denies it, but I don't think Walter Hill was interested in using this movie as a piece to try to change that. I don't think Walter Hill was interested in social commentary with this.
You know, what we saw him say in the various interviews, I agree. I don't think that that was his intention to criticize it, but I think here's my reading. I think that the movie really does criticize law enforcement in the United States, largely based on, well, a few things. Like you said, the corruption is rampant. Nick Nolte himself is incorruptible. So he sets the standard against like the norm. The corrupt norm, basically. Even while also being racist, being misogynist, being ultra violent, abusing his power, ignoring normal law enforcement guidelines like paperwork and things like that. He doesn't do any of that. He hates it. So, and that's normal for these movies, right? That we see that in basically every buddy cop movie, every cop movie from the 80s. It's about a macho cop, you know, dirty, hairy, you know, all that stuff. It's not new necessarily, but the line that you mentioned earlier, where Nick Nolte is trying to apologize for saying the things that he said to Murphy, and he says, I'm sorry about what I said earlier. I was only doing my job and keeping you down. To me, that's an ultimate indictment of police work in the United States.
I can see that. Yeah,
I mean. It's pretty hard. I mean, it's pretty harsh reality, right? Like, I don't know. I that's a reading, I guess. And after I watched it, that was the feeling that I got, regardless of what Walter Hill's intention, I guess. I think he, like you said, he wanted to make an action film with some comedy in it. And clearly they wanted comedy. They wanted Richard Pryor earlier. So it wasn't a new thing that came with Eddie Murphy. It was going to be they needed that, that lightheartedness, right? Because the movie's pretty harsh. It's pretty dark. There's some violent stuff in this. And like I mentioned earlier, like the last scene, you know, they're going to get Billy Bear, right? And Nick Nolte takes one of the girls hostage. He's like pushing her in front of him. I'm like, whoa, this guy's a cop.
Right.
Yeah. There's some harsh things in this. And I think there's some questions to be asked and answered when you're watching this film. I think it's worth watching if you can get past the questionable elements. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that's all really.
Yeah, no, I think so. And even Nick Nolte, you know, he's incorruptible in that he won't take a bribe, right? He's not on the take. But like you say, he's happy to break the law, though, because you see him forge the paperwork to get Eddie Murphy out of prison. He forges the paperwork.
Oh, he lies.
The guy says, right. You know, you'd have a career in forgery if you wanted to.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It's, like there's all kinds of crossing of the line, right?
Yeah.
And I guess the other thing, my other point to you was that I really think if that is part of the point of the movie, which we're not sure if it is or not, I think it's pretty ironic that this film spawned a genre throughout the 80s of macho ultraviolet cops being the heroes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I think that started before this, honestly.
Sure.
Like Dirty
sure,
Harry, right?
Absolutely. So, absolutely.
Definitely the other movies that mm-hmm. came after this that used this as a building block and used this as a template, you mm-hmm. know, they didn't necessarily.
Lethal Weapon. They're the good guys. They're the good guys. They're not nearly. Well, I haven't seen that for a while either. Maybe they are as violent. They're not nearly as racist.
So the original Lethal Weapon's pretty violent. It's not. Yeah. Yeah, the racism part's not in there like this. Mm-hmm. But the violence is like there's a lot of violence and blood in Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Mel Gibson gets electric, you know, he's electric, you know, tortured with electricity and he's.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I forgot about that stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it opens up with with the lady taking the dive off.
She jumps out. Yeah. Right?
But yeah. Huh. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know if you had any other thoughts about the original.
No, I mean, it is like I say, this was one of Water Hill's successful movies. You know, Water Hill is one of these directors that made a handful of successful movies and most of the movies were not successful. Mm. This one was. This one made a lot of money. And it, you know, but I mean, you think about the other movie, you know, we talk about, you know, a product that's time. We're not, it's beyond the scope of this podcast and what we're doing right now, but it'd be interesting to look at The Toy from 1982, which opened at the same time this did with Richard Pryor. Mm-hmm. And go back to that and see, you know, how palatable that is to today's audience.
Yeah.
It might not age well either.
I don't think it does. I haven't seen that for many years, but I kind of remember there being some racism in that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure there is. There.
I mean, it's a movie about a rich guy buying a black dude.
Right.
Be honest.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. So let's jump ahead to another 48 hours, the sequel. And we won't spend nearly as much time on that movie because, let's be honest, it's not as good. Eight years later, this is 1990. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay. 8 years later in 1990, everybody was, they're still out there. They're still making movies. Eddie Murphy had kind of had his high point, had a couple movies that weren't doing so good. And Eddie Murphy actually came up with the idea for the script originally. And Eddie Murphy is the one that came to everybody and said, let's get back together and make another 48 mm-hmm. hours, make another movie. And he actually has screenwriting credit on this mm-hmm. movie. He used the Fred Broughton name as a pseudonym for Eddie Murphy. That's what he.
Interesting. I saw that it was Eddie Murphy Productions. So he was a producer as well.
Yep. Yeah. And he was a producer as well. And he has top billing in this one. And he made money in this one that Nick Nolte did.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. But this movie is a hot mess. It really is. So the racism's gone now.
Yes.
Which is good. We're not going to say that's a bad thing. Women aren't treated any better in this movie. The misogyny is, maybe it's not as blatant.
It might be a little bit lighter.
But women are still not, there's no major female character in here. None of the women have real roles.
Right.
So they don't come out any better, really. The relationship between these two isn't, they try to hit the high points of the original movie in the remake. That's what they do, trying to hit the high points.
Right. There's some of the scenes are almost like verbatim.
Right. Yeah.
A lot of callbacks to the original. The villain is just the brother of the original villain, right?
And you know, you got a biker gang in here, but then they're working for this Iceman, who's this big drug dealer, who is the money that Eddie Murphy and gang stole the money from originally in the first movie. Now they've retconned that. And, you know, it turns out, again, we're talking spoilers here, folks. By the end of the movie, we find out that the Iceman is really a cop. And it's not even the cop you necessarily think it was going to be, right?
No, it's one of the cops from the original movie.
Right. It doesn't work. It just doesn't. The movie just, it's got a lot of action. It probably has more action in this than in the first
one. Yeah.
They use this ridiculous technique throughout the movie of when somebody gets shot, they've got them hooked up. They've got, you know, kind of pulley hooked to them, and they yank them out windows and they yank them back. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy.
Yeah. And everybody had a Desert Eagle. It's like,
yeah.
Everybody, giant guns.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, what's her name in Hunter shot him, you know, because every time it was a DD, every time she shot somebody with her 380, blew him through the window, right?
Yeah.
But in this, that first scene where that lady trooper walks in the little bar and gets blown out the window is just ridiculous. Yeah. They do it over and over. They have to do it half the time.
It's not soft. I guess I didn't really think about it. I noticed it, but I didn't really think about it at the time. But I wonder if Hong Kong cinema was starting to influence action films by then.
Maybe.
I mean, The Killer, Hard Boiled. I think Hard Boiled was 89. I wonder. Yeah. We get a lot of that and that kind of thing.
This movie isn't a total waste. There are some interesting things. You know, the fight at the end when they're in the birdhouse or whatever they call it, you know, the club with the cages that went up and down with the, you know, had the fog machine and the fog on the floor. Mm-hmm. You know, that was kind of cool. You know, there were some interesting things in the movie, but Eddie Murphy's not bad in the movie, but it's just not, I don't know. It's
you don't need to see it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's forgettable, I would say.
Yeah, there's so many other.
That said, maybe a little bit more palatable to the modern viewer because some of the stuff is gone. So I guess to each their own. And I don't know. I would have to say that you're right. The original is a more cohesive film, with a better story. And then there's the sequel, Another 48 Hours, is just an action film. Nothing special about it at all.
Do we even know where at the end of the movie the original money got to?
I want to space out by then, man.
So they meet, right? We get to the end of the original. Mm-hmm. Nick Nolte's kept this money in a duffel bag in his police locker. He gives it to Eddie Murphy, right? Eddie Murphy goes and gives $75,000 to Tisha Campbell, who's Bernie Casey's daughter, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the bad guys show up, they kidnap both them. And then the money, the 500 grand at the final shootout is money the Iceman supplied to pay off the bikers for killing the other biker. So there's still another 400,000.
Yeah.
Just kind of Eddie Murphy's original money that I guess Eddie Murphy still has.
Yeah. He must still have it. They don't even talk about it.
Yeah.
It's not mentioned. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I don't know. It's not worth thinking about.
This movie's just not, I don't know. It's just not as good. Yeah. But I wouldn't be opposed, you know, the remake and things. We've got a fourth Beverly Hills Cop coming out this year.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah. Direct to streaming.
Okay.
For what it's worth.
Mm-hmm.
But so we'll see how that's good or how that goes. But I wouldn't be opposed to seeing another team up. I mean, I don't know if Nolte would still be a cop here, even if it ended up being like, what's not like, I don't want to see a movie like Red, but what was the one with the old guys? And when they had the sequel, Sophia Loren was in it.
Hey, Jason in the editing room. Just want to add in the movie I was thinking about at this point of course, is Grumpy Old Men and Grumpier Old Men, starring Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau. So, great, great movies. Highly recommended. But let's get back to the show.
I wouldn't mind, though, having a movie with, you know, with a older Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte in it getting back together for something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I would be willing to support a third movie in the series.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I don't know. I'm game. I mean, you never know. I like we go on about remakes and too many sequels and all of that, but yeah, I mean, it can be done. Did you happen to see the Coming to America sequel? I didn't see that.
I did, and it was fine. You know, it hit all the beats. It had the people in, you know, a lot of the original actors in there, which is great. But it was more like one of these TV reunions shows than anything. It was like, yeah, you're happy to see everybody, but you forget what happened the day after you watched it.
You know? Yeah, I gotcha.
It wasn't great either. It's, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this needs to be remade because effectively every buddy cop movie since this remade it already. So maybe it's something you're going to bring to your gaming table. If you're going to bring this to your gaming table, what game would you use to bring this kind of story, a buddy cop story, to your
table? So you're asking me. So
yeah, I'm asking you, if you were going to run a buddy cop game, say you had a night where only two players were going to be able to show up, and so you're going to run a buddy cop adventure. What system
do you use? I have to be honest, like I don't really run or play a lot of modern games. So I was kind of stumped with this question. The game that I've played the most would be like D20 Modern, but I don't think that would be my choice. I want something a little bit more narrative, a little bit more easygoing, like Beer and Pretzels type game, right? Not a lot of number crunching and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I kind of wondered if Burn 2D6 would work. Haven't looked deeply into it, but I got the sense that it might be a little bit too pulpy. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
So I think for a buddy cop game, the important thing is for the system to get out of your way.
Mm-hmm.
And Burn 2D6 would do that for you.
Cool.
I think having a real, you could do it with any system, really. It doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. You have to have a system where you don't have enough. It can't be a game where you have to have certain archetypes in the party. Like you could do a D&D buddy cop thing, but I don't know that D&D is the system I'd run it in.
You know
what I mean? But you could do a medieval buddy cop game.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But because buddy cop, basically we're talking an action movie with an odd mm-hmm. couple, right?
Right. The setting is separate from the genre.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You could do a buddy cop type thing in, you know, medieval times or fantasy or Eldritch Horror even. Like, you could do all that stuff. Yeah.
Right.
So good.
Oh, I was just going to say, so yeah, I think Burn 2D6 is definitely an option. Lately I've been looking at a system. I haven't run a game in it yet, so I still need to run it. I've run buddy cop games before using a couple different systems.
Mm-hmm.
But Deep Sixes, One Page Rules, I've used those before and they work fine.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I these days I've been looking at Visceral, which is a game that's a newer game. You can get it on itch.io. It's from Van Gool Games. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's just 3 pages of rules, but I really like it because it looks like it'll go very quickly.
I wonder if there's a Tunnel Goons hack that could work for this. I know there are just quite a few of them on itch. I didn't think to look at it until you just said that. What about Secrets and Lies? I know you have some experience with that.
Well, I've looked at it. I haven't played it. That would very possibly work too. Like I say, I'm kind of interested in this Visceral right now, this game on itch, Visceral from Van Gool Games. And it's kind of interesting. It's only 3 pages, but it's set up where it'll just get out of your way and it doesn't get granular at all as far as equipment or counting bullets or any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's got a risk your luck mechanic in there to help it along, which I like. And I just think Visceral, it just feels like it would work pretty good for a buddy cop game. So that's kind of what I'm leaning towards next. I want to try for a buddy cop game.
Very cool. I'll have to look at that one. Yeah.
System. But yeah, I definitely think the, you don't need a game that gets detailed with guns or cars or
right.
equipment or gear, because none of that matters.
Yeah. These movies aren't stories about what kind of gear you have or how long it lasts. It's about the action and it's about the story moving quickly.
Right. And you know, I ran a game, I believe the RPG is Double Trouble. I'll make sure that's the right name of it. I'll put a link in the show notes, but it was designed to run like the anime and the manga, the Dirty Pair or like, And I ran that for a couple buddies and it worked really well for them. The problem with that one is that it's set up specifically for that genre. So what happens in that game is you're competing against each other and you're trying to score points and all. And I think you can modify that for a buddy cop game, but it would take some modification where I think Visceral, you wouldn't have to modify it. I think Visceral would work pretty well just as it is. So that's very cool. Why I'm interested in that.
Again, Jason, the editing room. I have run a session of Visceral since we recorded this podcast. Joe Richter of Hindsightless and another friend of ours played football players in the 70s who got stuck in some instances on a road trip with some racists out west, and it worked out really well. And I'm looking forward to doing the follow-up game where they end up in Las Vegas with a showgirl they helped out during that road trip and have some adventures in Las Vegas. So far, Visceral is working really well. What it helps do is, because the way it's set up, you have some stakes, but you pretty much are going to succeed early on in the game. But slowly, your characters get beat down, so the real stakes happen in the third act of the game. So they happen later on in the game, which mirrors most of these buddy cop movies. You don't lose the shootouts and lose the chases and get beat up and captured in the first few minutes or even the first half hour of a buddy cop movie. It's near the end that things are really serious. And I think Visceral works really well to mirror that. So I'm looking forward to further playtesting it. And now I'm going to let you get back to the show.
Yeah, so we've got maybe a game or two in mind that we might use to run this. So we're not sure if we want to recommend. Well, I would recommend people watch this, provided they understand what they're getting in for 48 hours, not so much another 48 hours. But if you were going to do a double feature for 48 hours, or maybe say watch this instead, what movie would you put either with 48 hours or in its place?
So a double feature, I would just go with the Eddie Murphy duo and say Beverly Hills Cop 2 probably. I feel like that's a better film than the first one. Thinking back, I haven't seen these for years too, so I could be completely wrong. To replace it though, I always had a soft spot for a Lethal Weapon, but I don't know that I would pick that. It's a little bit different. It's less comedic, I think. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the same thing, Beverly Hills Cop. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a great way to go. If I was going to pair this up with something, you could definitely keep doing the Eddie Murphy thing, but I think I would look towards, like say Running Scared's a good earlier example of this. Well, it's after this, but it's a fairly early buddy cop movie. If you want to watch another one that's really leans in the comedy aspect, like Dragnet. I've always liked Dragnet. You don't have.
Oh yeah, sure. Oh yeah, I forgot about Dragnet.
Yeah, with Tom Hanks and Dan Aykroyd. Mm-hmm. That's a favorite of mine. But a modern movie that would, I think, fit pretty good if you're looking for a buddy cop movie would be The Nice Guys. I think The Nice Guys is a really good example of a modern buddy cop movie.
Seen that.
Russell Crowe and I'm brain farting on his name. The guy Ryan Gosling. Yep.
I've definitely not seen this.
Oh, check it out. Yeah. That's worth your time to watch. The Nice Guys is a good modern buddy cop movie.
Yeah. I'll put this one on the list. Yeah. 2016. I've never even, don't think I've ever heard of it, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. Huh. No, highly recommend it. Check that out. It's good. Okay. Well, Joe, thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on, Jason. That was a good time. Interesting film. I think a really interesting film choice. But yeah, awesome, dude. Appreciate it.
Okay. Take care.
You too.
Joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if I could shoot him dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. Butcher is a dustman and your moil is by the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away, don't look away, don't look away, don't look away. Well, the zombies are arising and the world has gone to heck. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the train wreck.